Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, an Apple Premier partner. TechServe has been supporting New Yorkers for 29 years with Mac repairs and upgrades, including data recovery, liquid damage, hard drive issues, general troubleshooting, and more. TechServe.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. An EPA Midwest regional official, Susan Hedman, did you catch this, becomes the first federal casualty, she resigned, in the Flint, Michigan water crisis. Looking back, this might have happened much sooner. The Flint story is about national journalists asleep at the switch as much as anything. The story had been a crisis for the Flint community for many months. This hour, we will contrast the shortcomings of the well-paid celebrity reporters on TV with some unsung, even unknown journalists working in some of the worst places on earth, trying to protect some of its most vulnerable people. We will also evaluate the safety of those folks who take it upon themselves to exercise their democratic freedoms to hold the powerful to account. We'll talk about how the Constitution is basically nullified when people are willing to tolerate the intensive surveillance by governments using technological tools that once belonged exclusively to freedom fighters and democracy's rebels. We will also take a playful look at the commercial potential of high-quality premium paranoia. The X-Files returns to broadcast television with the old 90s gang, including Agents Scully and Mulder, all back. Right. Broadcasting. From where? Another civilization? In another galaxy, perhaps? You don't believe in the syndicate, do you? Do you? But right now, let's begin with talking about a very serious side of protecting and fighting for reporters who challenge powerful nations, violent insurgencies, and rich and powerful commercial interests, controlling everything from illicit drugs to agriculture and water resources. The state of press freedom and its bravest warriors. Warriors like Jason Rezaian, the Washington Post reporter released from prison by Iran this week, or the team of journalists at Tolo TV in Afghanistan killed by a Taliban suicide bomber. Joel Simon is executive director for the Committee to Protect Journalists, and Nazila Fati is author of The Lonely War, One Woman's Account of the Struggle for Modern Iran. She's a former Tehran bureau chief for our partner, The New York Times. Both Joel and Nazila are relieved and alarmed by what happened to Jason Rezaian.
I'm very happy that he is out of prison. He's back here, but I don't think he should have been there in the first place. He was a reporter, and I never saw him write anything controversial or provocative. The fact that he was arrested in the first place and the fact that he was held for 500 days in a notorious prison is very alarming. And I don't think it's going to make things easier for other reporters who are still in Iran and working. It just shows how unpredictable the situation is, how unreliable Iranian authorities are. And I think all the other reporters who are in Iran feel that they're not safe there.
Jason had become a kind of judicial hostage. He was in jail for nothing to do with his journalism. This was clear. The entire legal process was a farce. It was transparently manipulated. So he was taken because of this suspicion by the Revolutionary Guards. They were apparently suspicious of his reporting, and he was taken to leverage certain advantages politically in terms of the international environment, and Iran essentially was successful in that effort. So he was a judicial hostage, and he's free to a certain extent because the ransom was paid.
I don't want to be annoying or, I don't know, superficial here, but I think it does bear comparison, the Flint water crisis and the timing of U.S. journalists getting on that story, and a story like Tolo TV, which has confronted aggressively the Taliban. Tell that story and how you see their mission and their vulnerability here in this environment where journalists in places like this are extraordinarily vulnerable.
Well, this is in Afghanistan, and Tolo TV really is a groundbreaking media enterprise. It's the Mohseni family, which was, they were sort of exiled during the Taliban period, and they had some resources. Saad Mohseni was living in Australia. He brought that to bear, invested it in Afghanistan, attracted additional international investment, and created this truly independent media network that not only covers the news, it brings in cultural programming, soap operas, talent shows. It really has transformed the media environment. And aside from the Taliban, of course, Afghanistan's a very conservative place. So this sort of had repercussions throughout the society. And of course, the challenging way that it covered government activities brought pressure to bear from the government. So really, Tolo TV is a phenomenon. It's a phenomenon. It really is a quite a remarkable media enterprise in this in an environment in which there's never been free media. And the Taliban essentially declared Tolo TV a media target because of their critical coverage. And now it appears they've carried out that threat.
Nazila, your colleague Rukmini Kalamachi did some amazing reporting last year, which really showed that Al-Qaeda, for instance, creates this kind of transaction in hostage-taking that includes journalists putting prices on people's heads. How has that had an impact on the way journalists see themselves reporting in the Middle East?
Well, if you remember, it all started with Daniel Pearl, who was beheaded in the beginning of the war. So I think that was the most alarming message that was sent to reporters. And since then, people who were working in these areas were very, very aware that they were targets, that the Taliban, various terrorist groups, could take them as hostages. And later on, since then, there have been many, many others whose lives have been taken because of this. And I think this is the first time, the past decade almost, that reporters who were just messengers, who were people who were carrying the message, they thought they were empowering people by giving them information, they've become targets themselves. It undermines what they are doing when they have to constantly worry about their own security and safety. It limits their ability to cover issues, to go to places. And this is not good for journalism at all, not good for journalists per se, and not good for what happens afterwards, the information that comes out of it.
Joel, a citizen journalist armed with digital tools were seen as a way of pushing back when Western reporters or large media outlets in Europe and the United States couldn't get in to report in places. We've seen this month that perhaps that is not a countermeasure. And you talk about something called new censorship in thinking about the way people are responding to some of these journalist vulnerabilities. Explain.
Linking the things we're talking about today, we have Jason Rezaian in prison for 18 months. He's the correspondent for The Washington Post. I mean, if you were the correspondent for The Washington Post 15 years ago, for example, you had a force field around you. Nobody would touch you. You had this incredible protection because of your visibility. And then we have the attack on Tolo TV, eight media workers killed in Afghanistan. And if you look at the data, this is the most deadly and dangerous time for journalists ever. More journalists in prison, more journalists being killed. So what's happening out there? We have a very complex media environment where where journalists who once collectively exercised this kind of information monopoly, if you wanted to communicate to the world, even if you were a bad guy, you had to talk to the journalists. That's no longer the case. Governments, non-state actors have other ways of communicating, so journalists are more vulnerable. And you have, as you described, citizen journalists, local journalists, non-journalists who are using these journalistic tools participating in this activity of gathering and disseminating information to the public. But they're incredibly vulnerable. They don't have institutions behind them. They don't have governments behind them. They don't have that visibility. And so we have a very robust information environment, but the people who are bringing us the news have never been more vulnerable.
Is the New York Times press credential, Nazila, a force field anymore?
I'm not sure. When I left the country, when I left Iran in 2009, I left under huge pressure So I think things had started to change in Iran as well. I mean, in Iran, I was always respected as a New York Times reporter. I had access to people. But all along, I knew there was another force in the country that was trying to target me. I was summoned every once in a while for interrogation. I was threatened. There were times that my press credentials were taken away. And so I was always very aware that while the New York Times gave me some protection, it gave me huge visibility, it also made me a target. I could always be a potential hostage, but I didn't know what the purposes would be and how long they would hold me to get what they want. Jason's case was a very scary one because he was held for 500 days. Before Jason, everybody else was released within 3 months. So I'm not sure if any reporter has any kind of protection because of other news organizations.
Joel Simon, before we go, you commented on the media environment now. Contrast the publications and the very glossy ISIS-generated media materials, which reach the same people as journalists who are presumably making the decision as citizens of these vulnerable societies, and some in the United States and Canada, whether they want to join up. They're evaluating whether ISIS is a legitimate operation or not, and they have the ISIS magazine versus, you know, The Economist to choose from.
Well, I mean, I think what the ISIS magazine shows is just that anyone can participate in this media environment. These tools, I mean, we obviously the Islamic State has been quite effective in utilizing Twitter and other social media tools. They publish this glossy magazine that looks like journalism, and it's very effective in terms of their ability to communicate with the people they want to communicate with, including their followers and people they want to inspire around the world. And this is why they kill journalists, because they don't need them. They don't need them. I mean, when you, 15, 20 years ago, when you were in the field and you would encounter folks like ISIS as a journalist, you would say, if you kill me, who's going to tell your story? I'm sure that's what Danny Pearl said. That's not an argument that wins the day anymore, because they have other ways of communicating. You're dispensable. In some cases, you're more valuable as a prop in a terror video.
Joel Simon is executive director for the Committee to Protect Journalists and author of The New Censorship: Inside the Global Battle for Media Freedom. Also with us was Nazila Fati, who's the author of The Lonely War, One Woman's Account of the Struggle for Modern Iran, and former Tehran bureau chief for our partner, The New York Times. Nazila and Joel, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
I don't know if you've noticed, but the equity markets, the commodity markets, and bond markets have all been about as tranquil this week as a trio of cats tossed into a clothes dryer. No. I would never do that. I've never done that. But the sagging price of oil, the great sucking sound coming out of the slowing Chinese economy are all having an effect on stocks that would appear to have nothing to do with either of those. But a looming squeeze on liquidity in an environment where credit has been easy for tech companies has meant that some tech stocks are hitting the brakes. Some investors see their cash pipelines slowing down, and the markets are suddenly looking dubiously at the valuations of a lot of hot tech stocks. Joining us is Lise Beyer, founder and partner of Class 5 Group, a public offering consulting firm in Silicon Valley. Lise, welcome.
Thank you very much. Nice to join you and those cats in the dryer.
Yes, exactly. One of them is Twitter, trading below its IPO offering price. What does that mean, do you think?
Oh, gosh, most of the companies that went public last year are, in fact, trading below their IPO price. And in short, what it means is people have less confidence in the future earnings ability of those companies than they did 6 or 8 months ago. But that could change again tomorrow.
Is this simply a reality check of valuations that have gotten inflated, or is there a real liquidity squeeze looming and that a lot of gut checking is going on in terms of the cash positions of investors who might actually keep this going?
Well, would that there were a simple answer. It's a little bit of both. You started this conversation by pointing out the what's going on with oil and what's going on with China, and those big macroeconomic events have a not only a tangible impact, but also a psychological impact. They're a big part of the Dow Jones, and every day people are waking up and hearing the Dow is down another X hundred points. And you hear that day after day, it begins to shake people's credibility. Their
confidence.
Thank you very much. Yes, their confidence. So that's item number one. Item number two is also something you've already alluded to, which is over the last few years, there's been so much enthusiasm for some of these stocks that, as we like to say, some of their valuations have gone very far over their skis. And there's a gut check going on. In theory, the price of a stock represents the discounted stream of future earnings. And what that means is if they're going to earn $5 a share in 2 years and $5.80 in 3 years, you add up all the future earnings and then you say, yeah, but that's way out there. So I'm going to take a certain percentage off the top of that and bring it back to what those dollars in the future would be worth today. And there was a point last year where people just weren't doing any math. They were just saying more is better. And this particularly happened with private companies.
Let's talk about, since you mentioned skis, GoPro. What's wrong with this? Seems like such a hot thing you'd want to have, that everyone's going to have one. You see the devices for sale everywhere, yet the stock, the company can't even demonstrate how it's going to make money.
And there you've hit the nail on the head. On one hand, you have a very sexy computer product, a consumer product that so many people were so excited to get and to ski with and to bike with and to strap on. I don't know, I saw one last week on the side of someone's car. So there's a certain amount of enthusiasm about this company can sell products forever. I've got to own a piece of it. I know what it is. I know what it does. Then there's the problem of what have you done for me lately? The stock market isn't about what's happening today. It's about the value of what's going to happen later. And for all the near-term enthusiasm about the GoPro cameras, the question the market seems to be asking now is, okay, what's the next product? Was this all about being a one-trick pony, or can you bring me something else in a few months that will generate just as much enthusiasm and keep consumers rushing back to stores to put more money in the company's coffers?
You know, in the old days, I mean, GoPro was just a device. And, you know, it was a company that sold retail devices. And maybe they'd have an improved model that would come out. But strategically, I don't understand why VCs and even companies are positioning themselves as these vertical entertainment companies. Okay, you've got a sexy device. That means you have to have a movie. And then you have to have, like, celebrity endorsers who do videos and movies. And then it becomes this whole entertainment channel. There's got to be a limit to the number of those that there can possibly be in the world.
There does, but what really matters is how much potential investors want to believe. There's a long history in technology of cool, jazzy consumer products, the Walkman, remember the Pure Digital, the flip video camera. There's a hot new device, and for the longest time, people would invest in the potential sales of those new devices. But those who sell the stocks and the investors who own them already and managements like to look to the future and say, how can I make my product even more valuable? And of course, the company who's done it brilliantly is Apple. Used to be a computer company. Now, the value is in things like iTunes and all the incremental products that they sell, the content that they sell that will run on the hardware that used to be the core of the business. So other companies are trying to follow that very lucrative, very successful path.
Give us a percentage before we go, and less than a minute. What percentage of this is a strategic course correction within the tech space, and what percentage of this is driven by outside forces like the Chinese, a potential contraction, and commodity prices?
Stock prices are always a reflection of the trade-off between risk and reward. A while ago, everyone was very excited about potential reward and how fast these companies could grow. Now, with these outside issues, there's a greater fear impact. I'm going to say that the initial psychological and real change that comes from oil prices is probably responsible for half, and the fact that valuations became totally disconnected from the reality of what these companies can earn is definitely the other half. And probably that ratio will switch to 70-30 as we move forward.
From 50-50 to 70-30, those are pretty precise numbers there from Lise Buyer. Thanks so much.
Certainly, it's been a pleasure. And, you know, nothing in the market is quite that precise, but trying to answer your question.
Lee Spire is a founder and partner of Class 5 Group, a public offering consulting firm in Silicon Valley. Catherine Smith has been promoted to become the Buffalo Bills' new special teams quality control coach. If the position sounds a tiny bit obscure to you, it is perhaps because Smith has become the first full-time female coach in the NFL, and quality control is an entry-level position. Pro football's problems with women can hardly be remedied with a single hire, let alone one at what's called the entry level of the coaching staff, primarily involved in computer analysis of player performance. Natalie Randolph is an NFL fan, one of the 45% of football fans who are women. She used to play wide receiver for a professional women's team called the DC Divas. She became head coach of the Coolidge High School football team in Washington, D.C., the Coolidge Colts. Now she's an eighth grade physical science teacher at Alice Deal Middle School. Natalie, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So do you have a reaction to Catherine Smith becoming this first full-time female coach in the NFL?
I think it's great. I think it's a great step forward. I'm really happy that it happened and that Coach Ryan was, you know, brave enough to do this and give her the opportunity. I think it's all positive.
It's a fringe position, though. It's not like she's going to be at the center of everything, like even a high school coach, as you were.
Right, right.
With some of the issues with domestic violence and parenting in the NFL involving players, it seems to be maturity is an issue. And I'm wondering if women could play a better role in helping these young men to act a little bit more grown up on the field, and that maybe male coaches emphasizing other traits and other principles and other values overlook maturity sometimes.
I don't think they overlook it. I mean, it's, you know, that's a problem. I would say it's a generational thing, maybe. You know, there is something to be said by a different approach or a different feel coming from a woman versus a man. You know, with my particular students, I was kind of that maternal figure for them in some ways, not all. And I also had to serve in a paternal sense for some of them. And high school is different. You know, we are there kind of as their protectors rather than someone who works alongside of them. But I think that maturity issue is kind of widespread. And yes, a diverse approach would help, I believe. But I don't think that the male coaches necessarily overlook it.
All right, I'm going to put you on the spot here, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Catherine Smith will have, you know, the opportunity to give advice to young players on special teams. In mm-hmm. her role, she'll be taking data from films and mm-hmm. Performance data and saying, you know, you're not doing this. You maybe need to do this. Thinking about you as having been a full coach of the entire team on high school, what advice would you give Cam Newton, who's had a great season?
If anything, I would say relax and, you know, just play football as you know that you can, and you have to go out there and want it. But that would be a motivation that anybody could tell him. Football is a science. You know, it is, yes, a sport, but it's a very complex sport with a lot of different moving parts and a lot of different strategies that lead you to a win. So with her position, she is part of that science team. Yes, she's going to be giving advice to the players. She's not going to have that much probably player contact, but she's going to play a huge part in breaking down all of that information and making sense of it. And she's been around the game for a long time. And as with any sport, any activity that has a coach or a mentor figure, it is just teaching. It's about information. It's about breaking down that information, finding trends and finding patterns so that you can predict an outcome a little bit better than your opponent. And I think that transcends gender. That has nothing to do with gender or whether or not you've played. Yes, it helps if you've played, if you've had, you know, the physical experience of it. But football is a science. And if anybody spends any time at any football program, whether it be high school, college, or NFL, you'll see the complexity of that sport. And when you are a player in a specific position, you know, you tend to focus on that position, and you do need others to break down all of that information for you and give it to you in the context of what you're doing and how you can do your job better.
Natalie Randolph is an NFL fan and an eighth grade physical science teacher at Alice Deal Middle School, once the high school football coach for the Coolidge team in Washington, D.C., the Coolidge Colts. Thanks so much, Natalie.
Thank you.
You want answers?
You haven't answered my question.
You want answers?
I want the truth!
So, do you come to Milwaukee often?
You know how fast you were going?
How can we be expected to teach children to learn how to read if they can't even fit inside the building?
You're gonna have to answer to the Coca-Cola Company.
You can't handle the truth!
You can't handle the movies if you're going out in the snow this weekend, but we've got some recommendations for you. It is Friday, time for the movies. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Rafer Guzman is with us, film critic for Newsday. Welcome.
Hi, John.
So what do we got? It's sort of Oscar pressure and Oscar relief in the sense that some of these movies will have nothing to do with the Oscars, but they're just out. Let's begin with The Fifth Wave. This is kind of an alien attack, dystopian, end of the world sort of thing. Let's listen.
It's okay. You're safe here.
No. All right, we're not safe anywhere anymore.
Why did you want to know how close Rod Patterson was?
To my brother. The army took him there, so I need to get him back. What?
Should eat. You gotta get your strength back.
Why'd you bring me here? What do you want?
My family. I couldn't save them, but I could save you.
Those people sound a little nervous. Wright Patterson, Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio, where I was born. But
All right.
No commentary on this movie.
Well, you never know. You might like the scenery, John. If you want to see Ohio being destroyed, there's an alien invasion here that comes down, spaceship hovers over the Earth, begins decimating the human race methodically in a series of waves. You know, first come power outages, then disease, then earthquakes, tsunamis. I think what we have here is another entry in the young adult sci-fi franchise, much like The Hunger Games, much like Divergent, based on a series of novels. Chloe Grace Moretz there plays a girl who's trying to fight to find her little brother. As far as these things go, I think it's actually really well directed, really well executed. It moves at a great clip. It's got a good cast. The action scenes are harrowing and very intense. I think the problem is this is really familiar territory. If you've seen all these young adult franchises over the last few years, you have seen this one already, and there's nothing this thing does. I'm not even sure there's anything this movie can do to make itself fresh and stand out from the pack. It as good as it is, it just feels like a very late arrival to a game that has already been played out.
X-Files with kids and with no subtlety, I guess, is this genre, we might say. All right, number two, Anomalisa. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
I think you are, yes.
This actually is in Oscar contention. Tell us about it.
Right. This is a new film from Charlie Kaufman, who did Being John Malkovich.
Love
adaptation.
Him.
It's about a British author, Michael Stone. He's traveling through the United States on a book tour and lands in Cincinnati, Ohio. And he meets a young fan and kind of falls in love with her. And the reason he falls in love with her is because he likes her voice.
I was just looking for someone. I think I've got the wrong...
Who's there, Em?
It's Mr. Stone. Michael Stone.
Really? Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Hello? Oh, do I look awful? I was just taking my makeup off. Oh, my God. Ugh, don't look at me.
Hello. No, you look lovely.
It's got that Charlie Kaufman feel.
Yes, it does. Now, here's what's unusual about it. This is a stop-motion animated film. Like you were saying, it's Oscar-nominated for Best Animated Film. Stop-motion, rated R, rather sexually explicit, I would say. What's interesting about this movie is you really only have three people in it. David Thewlis, who plays Michael Stone, Jennifer Jason Leigh, who plays the voice of Lisa, and every other person in this film, every man, woman, child, every voice on the television or radio is played by Tom Noonan. The main character cannot distinguish between anyone else's voice, and so he falls in love with Lisa because he can hear her voice. I'm not a big Charlie Kaufman film fan, but this was one of my favorite films of the year.
Wow.
It was fantastic. Yeah.
That's great.
And if you like Charlie Kaufman, I think you're going to love this.
And what's the name of it again?
Anomalisa.
Anomalisa. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
Question: why did the U.S. government drop the ball on a crucial investigation into real evidence of an invasion by creepy, shape-shifting alien creatures hiding in replicas of humans? Here's an example of where intensive government surveillance might have been a force for good.
In 2002, in a change of direction and policy, the FBI closed the X-Files, and our investigation ceased. But my personal obsession did not.
All right, you fans of the show The X-Files know where I'm going here. That was David Duchovny playing the humorless, determined agent Fox Mulder on The X-Files. We learned this week that they are back. Cult fans of the show drove a reboot that will be endless fun and gratuitous paranoia for our colleague Jolenta Greenberg, comedian and pop culture critic. Hello, Jolenta.
Hello.
And we know you from all kinds of things on the program.
We do.
Right, but in fact, you're an infiltrator from an alien civilization, correct?
Exactly.
Which is exactly how X-Files would approach this segment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what is the significance of X-Files coming back? It is certainly the spookiest show of the 90s by far.
It's a big deal. A lot of people think the X-Files paved the way for this golden age of television we say we are in right now.
In other words, we're cult hits actually become binge-watching communities.
Exactly.
It's a show that could make almost anything seem weird. And here's an example.
I don't see it.
Weird music.
Mm-hmm.
There it is. Tucked away in the far corner behind the pipes.
It's hiding.
And there's something gross, right?
Oh, my God.
Oh, it's grotesque.
I don't know if you can see it from here, but it has no sex organs.
Of course.
Sexual reference, always.
Yep.
Pleti homenthes are often hermaphroditic.
Often hermaphroditic.
Mulder, this is amazing. Its vestigial features appear to be parasitic, but it has primate physiology.
She's a medical doctor.
Where the hell did it come from?
I don't know. But it looks like I'm going to have to tell Skinner that his suspect is a giant blood-sucking worm after all.
Boom.
The perfect X-File setup for
so good.
Another scenario for the end of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Did anyone really figure out what was going on in the X-Files? Again, that was what allowed you to have more and more episodes.
Oof. It's a tough call. It involves the Syndicate, an evil secret government above the government organization, ultimately trying to repopulate planet Earth with human alien hybrids, the aliens having been from the Roswell crash originally.
Of course.
In the end, there are some super soldiers, and Mulder and Scully have a baby, baby William, but he was put up for adoption, and we don't know where he is. So I think a big fan question is, do we see him? Do we see what happens to him? Do they reunite? Is he a super soldier?
So how does that going to work? The old cast coming back, or do we have like new?
We have a lot of the old cast coming back. We obviously have Mulder and Scully returning, the original actors. We have Skinner, who ran the FBI. We have Monica Reyes. She was sort of a side character. We have the Smoking Man, which is a big deal because he was fully blown up in the show's finale. The show's creator, Chris Carter, assures people that they bring him back in a reasonable, believable manner. But for the X-Files, who knows what that means?
Artistically, what can they do besides just be spooky again?
I think it's a real return to, like, good storytelling on television. I don't mean to get too lofty, but I think there is some true, like, Joseph Campbell hero's journey taking place. And we have the original show creators returning to sort of revive and continue this mythology of these heroes accepting a call to action, struggling with supernatural forces, and overcoming adversity and learning and growing. It's something we always love to watch, and this gets us back to our roots of good stories.
So in this century, we've got all kinds of ways of capturing aliens
on
video, right?
We sure do.
So that could ruin the series or what?
Exactly, yes. All of the sort of one-off monster stories that The X-Files is really known for, they all start with someone seeing a crazy monster and then reporting it to the FBI.
And nobody believes.
But if we all have smartphones now, next time someone sees a sewer monster lurking behind a pipe, they'll just snap a picture, snap a video, send it to the FBI, and it's like, oh, it's right there. It exists. Like, we're done. So I want to see how do they incorporate new technology into the stories in a way that doesn't just sort of shut them down.
Jolenta Greenberg, comedian and pop culture critic, telling us all about the Herald of X-Files, starting
this Sunday night on Fox. I always feel like somebody-
few more comments from you on whether it concerns you that the government may be watching you. Is there a need for government surveillance? From Texas, unfortunately, yes. Our enemies will always be looking for a weakness, and if they know they can communicate electronically without fear of monitoring, it reduces our ability to defend against terrorism. Jacksonville Beach, Florida. What I search on Google is even more private than speech. It's thought. I search my darkest fears and deepest curiosities. If online posts are tied to you, how can you comfortably dissent? Whoever said dissent would be comfortable? Finally, this hour, if you are entertained by the X-Files, there's a new X-Files coming up. If a paranoid sense of being watched is plausible enough for you to love this show as entertainment, would you be equally interested in a documentary series that covers some of the same ground, without alien storylines, of course, stories of government intrusion, a conspiracy to disrupt people using their democratic rights to make change and getting thwarted? Further, would such a documentary experience compel you to take action based on what you saw? Well, this is the premise of a new series for the Pivot Channel, a holding of the Skoll Foundation's Participant Media Ventures. For years, it has funded media projects which it believes can spur people into action. The new series, Truth and Power, is a case in point.
The technology is effective as a surveillance tool to identify and then intimidate people who are daring to protest.
This should be concerning for everybody, this practice of dissuading dissent.
That's a clip of Robert Scheer and Black Lives Matter founder Alicia Garza from the first episode of the 10-episode docuseries that looks at the ways in which governments break the trust of its citizens, from the surveillance of protesters to state-sponsored malware. Brian Knappenberger is director of Truth and Power. He joins me now. Welcome, Brian.
Thanks for having me.
So a 10-part series essentially on all the ways your government is betraying and screwing you.
I guess that's one way.
Not financially, but in these other ways.
Yeah. The series is called Truth and Power, and it's basically we look at the sort of personal stories of people fighting abuses of power or going up against these kind of broad institutional failures. So we use as a jumping off point these stories of these people fighting back.
I remember the famous phrase that if elections – could actually change anything in a democracy, they would be immediately made illegal. And you learn a lesson like that repeatedly in this series, in that the quickest way to get the attention of government surveillance and the authorities is to exercise your democratic rights. And that's the story here with activist DeRay McKesson. Let's hear a clip.
We know that we've always been targets of the state, either violently or in terms of them using these methods to learn more about us and track us, but that doesn't deter us.
Soon after this interview, activist DeRay McKesson learned just how much he was being personally tracked. Documents provided through the Freedom of Information Act showed that the cybersecurity firm ZeroFox was watching him, assessing his influence, and then feeding that information to the city of Baltimore.
There you hear Maggie Gyllenhaal, your narrator, in one of the episodes of Truth and Power, talking about the experience of DeRay McKesson. Tell us that story.
Right. So that episode is about Black Lives Matter, and we chart how they've used kind of digital tools, similar to what you were just saying, to mobilize and to organize, but also how those tools have been used against them in all sorts of ways. You know, we look back at civil rights movements of the past and how programs like COINTELPRO, you know, surveillance was the go-to tactic with those programs, seeing who was meeting at what time and using other kinds of things in order to derail those movements. Now, I think we find ourselves in a time where something very similar is happening. But what's new is we have these new tools, new ways of communicating. So there's this part of that story that's historical and part that's very new. You know, what he's talking about there is their kind of growing awareness about both government actors surveilling them and also these private companies, as noted in the clip, ZeroFox, these sort of independent contractors who often do some of this dirty work.
And you can market to sell products, to basically get clients like the city of Baltimore to buy tools that allow you to harass people and watch them while they're exercising their democratic rights. And in a land of free speech, a commercial like this is completely legal.
Is passive monitoring enough? You need more. You want to look through your target's eyes. You have to hack your target. Rely on us.
I mean, that is so frightening. Act now, and we'll throw in a satellite that will allow you to see entire countries. I mean, that's right. Really what's going on there.
Yeah, we were amazed when we found that commercial. But what that shows is a billion-dollar industry in spy tools. And specifically, that's an ad for a company called The Hacking Team. And what was so amazing about that episode for us is that we actually got an interview with The Hacking Team as we were investigating this. We asked them about this stuff.
I'm sure they were proud of themselves.
And they were proud of themselves, very unapologetic about it. And I think the most controversial aspects of this is that they are actively, or were actively, we suspected at the time, selling this stuff to some pretty awful regimes. But when we got the interview, we asked them about the sales to these countries and to these dictators. And they said, no, we vet all this stuff very carefully. We don't sell to really bad actors.
We, of course, take some pains to examine the potential clients before we even make a deal with them to make sure that they're people that we feel comfortable doing business with.
In the middle of us creating the show, it's kind of amazing, Hacking Team was itself hacked. 400 gigabytes of their own company data, their internal communications, were just dumped online. And so we were in this very bizarre position that you don't find yourself all the time as a journalist, of having an interview with people saying one thing and then just having their internal communications dumped online and being able to sort of cross-reference. And of course, they were selling to some pretty awful people.
Woodward and Bernstein had that experience a few generations ago. But yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, there is an agnostic quality to this technology, in that the worms, the malware, the algorithms that take down your computer, they don't particularly care if it's an angel that's inserting it into, you know, some evil dictator's computer, or if it's the other way around. The evil dictator is trying to, you know, take down a civil rights organization or a humanitarian NGO.
That's right. And they're not particularly concerned with geographical borders either. If you're somebody in the United States protesting one of these regimes, there's a pretty good chance you could get tracked with the same tools.
What do you think of the participant media model? Jeff Skoll, who was a former president of eBay, created this foundation, funds feature films, and at least seems to be committed to a principle that the creation of content can also create activism.
Yeah.
Do you believe that?
I do. I mean, it's sort of at the core of sort of what I think a journalist or a filmmaker has to believe sometimes in the face of long odds. But yes, I think getting information out to the public is the key to active participation in a democracy.
Brian Knappenberger, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Brian Knappenberger is director of Truth and Power, which premieres today on Pivot. And here's something to take with you today as we listen to the alarming predictions for the mid-Atlantic winter storm roaring up the East Coast. For all those people who find it just a teeny bit satisfying that Washington, D.C. might be buried and muzzled by a snowstorm, here's a little bit of weather hyperbole, my favorite. Extreme weather, extreme trucks, extreme drivers. Yes, I'm talking about extreme ice road truckers.
These truckers blaze a trail through the most terrifying terrain on Earth. They conquer killer Arctic storms and carve roads through the ice-bound Northwest Territories of Canada.
If you're stuck this weekend, ice road truckers to the rescue, folks. Safe at home, watching under a warm blanket. Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Tell us a weather story. We'd love to hear it. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.